Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name's Clayton Boyce. I'm president of the National Press Club and news editor for Knight Ritter Tribune News Service. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. On Tuesday, December 21st, Vice President Al Gore will address the press club about the information highway. On Tuesday, January 11th, our speaker will be Kate Michaelman, President of the National Abortion Rights Action League. And on Wednesday, January 12th, Paul Duke, host of Washington Week in Review, will give his retirement address, just somewhere in Florida, I believe. Transcripts and audio and videotapes of this luncheon are available. The transcripts will be available for fax transmission within 2 hours. The transcripts or tapes may be ordered by calling 800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards provided at your table and pass them up. I'll ask as many as time permits. And this is our first luncheon where we have accepted questions by electronic mail on the computer internet. We posted an invitation for questions yesterday for messages to Larry King and to Santa Claus. As of this morning, the score was Larry King 100, Santa Claus 1500. So, sorry about that. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. Please withhold your applause until all the names are read. From your right, Eugene Methvin, Washington Bureau Senior Editor, Reader's Digest. Bob Garfield, Advertising Age and National Public Radio. Mary Ann Means, columnist for Hearst Newspapers. Gil Klein of Media General News Service, Vice President of the National Press Club, and as of Friday, President-elect of the National Press Club. Ellen Toomey, United States Information Agency. Wendy Walker Whitworth, Senior Executive Producer, Larry King Live. Reginald Stewart, Assistant News Editor, Knight Ritter Newspapers, and Chairman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Vera Glasser of Maturity News Service and the member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. William Eaton of Los Angeles Times. Mark Gunther of the Detroit Free Press. Owen Allman of Business Week. And Ben Shore of Copley Newspapers. I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, Melanie Abdo-Dramat, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Our speaker today is a talk show tycoon. He was born Larry Zeiger in 1933 in Brooklyn, the son of Russian immigrants. His broadcasting career began in 1957 with a pinch-hit announcing stint on a 250-watt Miami radio station, and he hasn't stopped talking since. Larry King's first radio talk show was a Man Off the Street interview program. It originated from Pumpernick's restaurant in Miami Beach. It made King a major presence at the beach and helped him perfect the touchy-feely conversational style that has become his trademark. Today, thousands of interviews and six marriages later, Larry King is credited with revolutionizing the road to public office. It started when Ross Perot decided to bypass the traditional press conference in favor of a casual TV conversation in which he announced his presidential candidacy on Larry King Live. From that moment on, there was a scramble by all the candidates and their campaign apparatchiks to reach the voters directly without the sometimes unflattering filter of the political press corps. That's us. Just about any luminary you could name, including President Clinton, has solicited an appearance on Larry's show. As Larry tells it, a man recently called him one day and said, "Hi, Larry, this is Al." Al who, Larry asked. Al Gore was the reply. So you see why the Washington Post had christened Larry King the microphone of choice. Please welcome America's Yakmaster, the Pope of Talk, Mr. Larry King.
Thank you. Oh, the Pope of Talk. If my late mother were living, she'd die. We're of the Jewish faith, and the word Pope strikes us. First, I thank you very much for being asked to appear here. I also bring greetings from Ross Perot. Spoke to Ross this morning. So I couldn't be here, but he did buy the building. I don't want to say he's angry, but we have to be out by 2. His volunteers are taking over. Also, I don't know if this is the kiss of death to appear here, you know, because Dr. Elders, before she came over here, I spoke to her, and she said, "What do you think I should say there?" I said, "Hey, nobody cares." So I call for a complete study of whatever we want to study, and whatever you want to do is fine with me. I really enjoy this kind of thing because we're among friends and peers, and this is the kind of thing I love to do. I've been on a real rampage lately of running around and finding myself walking into myself. I can't keep up with my own schedule. Last Friday, I flew to Los Angeles. Dawn Steele, the movie producer, threw a book party for me. And it was a testimonial to free speech, which, by the way, is what it's like to speak at the press club, a free speech. We normally get paid, but once you hear it's journalism calling, you know you're not getting paid. Really, the speaker circuit, as I was telling, is a license to steal. It's a fantastic place to be. Norman Schwarzkopf calls it white-collar crime. But as soon as they call you on the phone, if they say, "Hi, this is either the National Press Club, this is the Journalism Review, this is the Radio Television News Directors," no pay. We keep it, make it, and keep it all. But they are our friends. Anyway, but on the schedule, I was in L.A., and Dawn Steele had this wonderful book party with an eclectic group. I've never been in a room like this. Mayor Reardon of L.A. was there, and so was Michael Milken. I didn't know whether we were going to campaign or steal the house. Oliver Stone was there. He met Michael Milken. Milken told Stone that Wall Street wasn't the truth. I'm listening to all this. And then Sean Penn walked in. It was that kind of group. It was just Barbara Streisand came. I felt at home, another Jew. Then Saturday night, I went to this Marvin Davis Christmas party, which is an incredible party in Los Angeles. 33 violinists on the stairs playing. George Burns sitting in the corner, 98 years old, drinking a martini, smoking cigars. Red Buttons walked by and says, "Cut that out. You want to live long?" Then I flew to New York, did Letterman last night, got up this morning, it was foggy, took the train, got here to do this. And then tonight the Olander Foundation has its annual banquet, and I always MC that. And then tomorrow morning there's something going on at Union Station, I'll be over there, so I'm really running around a lot. So I'm looking forward to this only because you are a convivial group, only because this is fun to do, and I'm looking forward to the questions, because that's when we'll be serious. I'm not going to be serious when I talk. I don't like to talk seriously. I do a lot of speaking. You go around to groups, and they're all expecting some kind of serious tone, and I have nothing planned. In fact, I have no idea what I'm going to talk about. So we're all in this together. You came here saying, "What is he going to talk about?" And he came here saying the same thing. So we're all in this. It's a wonderful boat to be in. It's high risk-taking. It's why I like working live so much in broadcasting. There's nothing like live. Tape is boring, and 99% of the work I do is live, so I know that tonight at 9 o'clock, when Dick Cheney's on, he'll be live. We'll be on together. Whatever is said is said. Nothing can be planned, because you can't plan 9 o'clock, because it's live. If you were taping at 8 o'clock, you could change things and stop. So I love the live atmosphere, and I like the risk-taking aspect of going around speaking when you don't know what you're going to talk about. It's a great, great kick, and I'll tell you what it's like to be a speaker. That's what I'll do, in fact. I'll tell you what it's like to be a speaker, because you're used to speakers all the time. You come here every week, every other week. You get these prominent people. Al Gore is coming. That's terrific. You get wonderful speakers. You come, you sit down, you wait to hear the speaker. But I thought you might like to know what it's like to be a speaker. It's one thing to be in an audience. It's another thing to be a speaker, because when you're a speaker, you have to deal with a certain group of people. They're all over America. They're called speaker's chairman. These people have tunnel vision. They have one role in life: get a speaker. And then get the speaker to the function. That's their total role. And so most times it works very well, like here. Nobody bothered me. Is anyone here in Rotary? Okay, how do you explain Rotary to people who don't know Rotary? Rotary is a club. It's an international club. It's basically 100 guys. Brown suits, white socks. They sell each other insurance, sing Rotary songs, and go home. That's sums up a whole Rotary lunch. Anyway, this is a true story. This guy calls me up. This is years ago in Miami. I was just starting out, and I was starting to get a name for myself, and I was doing radio and television. And I really got to like it, and I also got to like speaking. And so I would take anything. If they called, I said yes. It didn't matter what. I just loved doing it. So this guy calls, true story, Miami Shores Rotary Club. This was like in January. He says, in June, we have our annual meeting. We invite the ladies to come. Now there are lady Rotarians. Then there weren't. He said, but it's a big event. Would you be our speaker? And I said, sure. And he says, wonderful. What is your topic? I said, well, I don't have a topic. He says, you must have a topic. I said, I don't have a topic. He says, this is Rotary. I said, I don't have a topic. He said, if we were inviting Eisenhower, we demand a topic. I said, call him. So I hung up, he hung up, and I thought nothing of it, right? Now, the next night, I'm about to go on the radio, WIOD in Miami. You never forget this moment. Like a minute to airtime, producer comes over and says, emergency call, line one. I pick up line one, I hit, chicka, chicka, chicka. It's this guy, speaker's chairman. He's at the print shop. They're printing up the flyer for my meeting. He says, we're printing up the flyer. Chicka, chicka, what is your topic? So I can tell that if I don't say something to this guy, I'm going to go through a six-month hocking with this guy. It's going to last forever. So I made up a topic. Now, I said something at that minute. This is 30 years later. I have no idea why I said this. To this minute, I have no idea why I said it. I said, my topic is the future of the American Merchant Marine. He hung up, I hung up, I thought nothing of it. And all I wrote down in my book was 8 p.m. Miami Shores Country Club on such and such a date. Now, in the subsequent 6 months, I wrote columns for the Miami Herald. I did radio shows, I did television shows, I made other speeches all around Miami. So when it got to that date, I didn't even remember it was Rotary Club. All I had written down was 8 o'clock, Miami Shores Country Club. I certainly didn't remember any conversation with any speaker's chairman. So I drive to the Miami Shores Country Club. There's a sign, parking lot full. I park a block away, and I'm walking up, and my ego's getting carried away that I drew this crowd. I mean, I am really impressed with myself. I get to the front of the building. God's honest truth, there's a sign in front of the building, tonight, the future of the American Merchant Marine. I said to myself, Jesus Christ, they got two speakers. I got the wrong night. Something's mixed up. Now the speaker's chairman comes running out. He's excited, he's beside himself. This tells you immediately a lot about Rotary. This topic, the future of the American Merchant Marine, broke their all-time attendance record. They came on wheelchairs from Fort Lauderdale to hear this. Guy says to me, we are so excited. We can't wait to hear about the future of the American Merchant Marine. And I said to myself, you can't wait. He takes me inside. They sit me on this dais. It's packed like 900 people. Oh, and a very right-wing group. I mean, real right-wing. I mean, I don't mind right wing, but they had a picture of Goldwater on the wall. On top it said Pinko. This group was not too sure if we should secede from King George. This was, anyway, I'm on the stage, I'm sitting there on the dais, so I'm getting a little nervous because I know nothing about this topic. Now the guy gets up to introduce me, the speaker's chairman, he's going to introduce me. And he says he took the day off work, State Farm, whatever. He took the day off work. He went to the library and he researched the history of the American Merchant Marine. And he proceeds to do a half hour on the American Merchant Marine. He's talking about tonnage, harbor size, munitions depots, how many shipments, etc. And he says, and now to talk about the future, here's Larry King. I got to admit, that's panic. You know, I walk the full length of the dais, I get to the microphone, I stare out, this whole audience leans forward. I don't know, gunished. So I figure if you don't know it, leave it alone. I never mention the American Merchant Marine. I spoke for a half hour, I talked about Dade County politics, I talked about our mayors, our system of government, I talked about the whole thing. I never mentioned the American Merchant Marine. I figure you don't know it, leave it alone. So finally I finish, I say thank you, I jumped off the stage and ran out. No applause, no laughter, nothing. I ran by one guy turning up his hearing aid, saying, did he mention Merchant Marine? I just run to my car, and I get in my car, I start the car up, and I say, I'll never speak again, I'll never go through this again, I don't need this in my life. You know, I'm sweating, and air conditioning's on, there's a banging on the window of the car. Speaker's chairman has followed me to my car. And the speaker's chairman is ticked beyond belief. Banging on the window, I hit the button, the window goes down, he sticks his head in the window. He's got his head in the window, I got my hand on the button. You're a little Jewish kid from Brooklyn, you never know power, right? This was power, because I could have sweated and guillotined this guy. So he backs off and he starts to scream, you never mention the American Merchant Marine. You never mention the future of the American Merchant Marine. We got the largest membership attendance in our history. I researched it, and you, now he's really screaming, never mention the future of the American Merchant Marine. I said, they have no future, and drove away. There's one way guaranteed not to be invited back. I once spoke, this is a good group, I spoke for the mafia. That's hard to believe. I know my friend Mario Cuomo doesn't think there's a mafia. Mario. I love you, Mario, you're one of my great friends. Trust me, Mario. And if you lived in South Florida, you knew there was a mafia. Now, I would think, like most people think, that if you're in the mafia, all you do is muff. In other words, that mafia gets up in the morning and crime, 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 and then go to bed. But that's not true. Mafia goes to movies, the kids go to school, they're even involved in charities. And this is how I found out. One day I was at Channel 4. I've always worked radio and television. I was at Channel 4. I can still remember the name of the guy who came in. Tay Voy was his name. He came in and he said, Larry, line 2 is for you. It's a boom, boom, giorno. I don't know any boom, boom, giorno. I pick up the phone, I said, hello, it was the last word I said. I said, hello, and his voice said, King, boom, boom, giorno. November 3rd, War Memorial Auditorium, Boys Town of Italy, it's a charity. Sergio Franchi is the singer, you're the MC. Black tie, 8 o'clock, hung up. I went. Something told me go to this. In fact, something told me it would be in my best interest to go to this. So on November 3rd, I drive up US 1, I-95 wasn't even open then. US 1, Fort Lauderdale, opposite the Sears on the circle. There's the big sign, War Memorial Auditorium. Tonight, Boys Town of Italy, Sergio Franchi singer, Larry King MC. I said, whew, boy, am I glad I wrote that down, glad I came. I get out of the car, there's a special place for people in the show. Boom Boom is there with a cigarette, dangling, just like he would look. Close your eyes, what would Boom Boom Journal look like? You're right, that's the way it looks. Boom Boom says to me, we are very glad you came. I said to myself, you're glad I came. Boom Boom takes me inside, I see Sergio Franchi, the late Sergio Franchi, wonderful guy, an old friend of mine. I go up to him, I said, Sergio, how'd they get you for this event? He says, guy named Boom Boom Journal called, I'm here. And it was an amazing charity. They had a cardinal flew in from Italy. They raised like $300,000. Really amazing. Boom Boom gives me my instructions. He says, okay, kid, go on stage, do 20 minutes, do all shtick, kid the audience, kid as much as you like, bring on Sergio. Don't turn up the house lights. I says, why would I do that, Boom Boom? He says, don't turn them up. I says, why? He says, well, there's a lot of competitors in the audience. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, there's people in the jukebox business, people in the olive oil business. There's a whole section of FBI agents. Leave the lights dark. So I go on, and they were a great audience. I had a wonderful time, and it was a smashing success. And if I do say so myself, it was a great evening. They were a great audience, hearty laughter, and Sergio came on. He sang for an hour. He broke the place up. They brought on the Cardinal. They gave him the check. It was terrific. Now Boom Boom's walking me to my car. It's the end of the night. Boom Boom is ecstatically happy. He says, "Hey, kid, thanks." I says, "My pleasure, Boom Boom." He says, "Kid, we loved it. The guys loved it." I says, "Boom Boom, thank you." He says, "Hey, listen, we owe you a favor." So I said, "Nah, Boom Boom, I don't want any favors. I was happy to do it." And then he says, "We don't like to owe favors." I suddenly sense that I have a marker on the mafia. So I said to him, the logical thing to say to me was logical. I said, "What do you got in mind? What do you got in mind?" Okay, this was 25 years ago. He said five words. I remember where the moon was. I remember the chill in the air. I remember what happened, went up my spine, the tingle that hit the back of my neck. No one in the room has ever heard these five words. You'll never hear them in your life. You might have seen it in a movie. I heard it that night said to me by Boom Boom Giorno at 10 after 11 on November 3rd. Boom Boom said to me, "Got anybody you don't like?" Now, in all honesty, if that is ever said to you, morality aside, put morality aside, first thing you think of is names. I saved the life of the general manager at Channel 4 that night. I said, finally, I ended. I said, "Hey, Boom Boom, I can't do that." He says, "Okay." He says, "You like horse racing?" I says, "Yeah." He says, "We'll be in touch." God's honest truth. 3 weeks later, the phone rings, a voice. I still don't know if it was Boom Boom. All I did was pick up the phone, said hello, and this voice said, "Apple Tree in the Third at Hialeah." I had $800 in my name. I borrowed another $500, went to Hialeah, bet $1,300 to win on Apple Tree in the Third. I'm standing, the horses are going in the gate. And I said to myself, "You know, there are three sure things in life. Death, taxes, and Apple Tree's going to win the Third." I especially knew it during the running of the race when five jockeys jumped off their horses. They have a way of affirming things. Sometimes you can speak to an audience and turn them around. And I'll tell this briefly, and then we'll take some questions, because I know there'll be questions about... No, I know there'll be questions about serious subjects, but I like to have fun when I speak, so I hope you're enjoying this. Sometimes a speaker, if you have just the power of a voice, it doesn't take a lot of ability. Mostly it's inborn, I think. You can take an audience and turn them around. I've seen great speakers. I saw Mario Cuomo do that. Mario Cuomo, to me, is one of the great public speakers ever. He's got a book out, a collection of his speeches that are fantastic. Mario also likes challenges. I once introduced him. He was going to speak, I think it was the New York Sheriff's Association. So he says, "I'm going to have a topic today." I said, "Okay." He says, "This is the sheriff's, right?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "I'm going to speak against capital punishment." I said, "Good thinking, Mario. The bus boys don't agree with you." He got up and he's killed them. That audience was unbelievable. They all disagreed with him, but he got a standing ovation just through the eloquence of his words. And you can do that. And it's a gift. It's pure. Mario knows it's a gift. It's a gift. If you have it, you have it. And if you're born with any kind of a gift of gab, and I had it happen to me early, I don't take any credit for it. It just was an extreme test under pressure. True story. Dick Gerstein called me up one day in Miami. He's the late Dick Gerstein. He died last year. He was district attorney for years in Miami. Major figure. In fact, he was the guy who hired Janet Reno when Janet Reno got out of Harvard. First person ever interviewed Janet Reno was me when he called me up one day and he said, "I got this great female prosecutor," which was then incredible to think of, female prosecutor, "who's going to be terrific someday, and you ought to put her on." I put her on the show. Gerstein really saw her coming. Anyway, he said to me, "Larry, I got a big problem." I said, "What?" He says, "There's two conventions going on simultaneously in Miami. Two. The National District Attorney Association and the International Chiefs of Police. Both conventions, same time. They're both supposed to wind up Sunday afternoon. They've decided, since they're both here at the same time, they're going to have a dinner Sunday night combining the two conventions at the Fontainebleau." And I said, "Well, what's your problem?" He says, "Well, we had to cancel our 3 o'clock closing meeting and switch our speaker to that. I'm the chairman of the dinner, and the speaker is Frank Sullivan. He's chairman of the Florida Crime Commission, and he's the world's most boring speaker. I can't change him. I can't cancel him. Now, I've got all these chiefs of police. I've got all these district attorneys, and I've got the world's most boring speaker. I said, well, how can I help you? He said, would you follow him? I don't want both conventions to end on a low note, and I know this guy's going to put him to sleep. So you follow them and give him a big, you know. I said, but nobody knows me. I'm just a guy. I'm just doing a local radio show. I just started on television. Nobody in the audience knows me. He says, I'll give you a big buildup. I'll give you a big buildup. So I go to this dinner. It may have been the first time I ever wore a tuxedo. I'm sitting on the dais. I'm staring out at this audience, like 2,000 people, district attorneys, chiefs of police, some of them in uniform. I'm really nervous. Frank Sullivan gets up to speak, chairman of the Florida Crime Commission, the world's most boring speaker. He had graphs. He had charts, and he spoke in a monotone. First person to go to sleep was his wife. She went into the baked Alaska. Boom. He's talking against crime, right? Speaks for a half hour. They give him a little tepid applause, and you could tell they're ready to get out of there. They were bored. Everyone was bored. So they're all standing up. Now here comes my introduction. Gerstein runs to the microphone and says, before you leave, my good friend Larry King. Right, so I stand up. I'm faced with this enormous dilemma. Nobody knows me. They just followed the most boring speaker. They're all anxious to go home. These are heavy hitters. It's the end of a big convention. I run to the microphone. Here's all I said. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm in broadcasting. And in broadcasting, we have a fairness doctrine, an equal time code. It's something I believe in from the bottom of my heart. We have just heard Frank Sullivan speak against crime. In accordance with fairness and equal time, I am here to speak on behalf of crime. It was unbelievable. You could have heard a pin drop. They sat down. I had their immediate attention. Now I got to think of something to say. So I said, how many people in this room would like to live in Butte, Montana? Not one hand went up. I said, Butte, Montana has the lowest crime rate per capita in the Western world. There were no crimes in Butte, Montana last year. Nobody wants to go there. What are the top five tourist cities in America? New York, Chicago, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Miami. What are the top five crime cities in America? New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Miami. Crime is a tourist attraction. People go where crime is. Sullivan's wife wakes up. I said, another great advantage of crime, when you think about it, is the money stays local. There's no federal government involved. The local bookmaker will go to the local restaurant, and the cash remains in the community. There's a flow of event to it. They tend to clean up their own neighborhoods, and when people are disloyal, they tend to take care of their own, saving us enormous police work. Now I'm starting to convince myself. And then I said, and another thing, this was the crown. I said, another thing, if we listen to Mr. Sullivan, if we follow his graphs and charts, if we do everything he said, we will wipe out crime in America. And what's the result? Everyone in this room is out of work. Police chief of Louisville, Kentucky jumped up and said, what can we do to help? Anyway, okay, I went down in a half hour already, talking for half hour, so I know we want to have some questions. I understand they're written out, and as I understand it, the person reads them. How does it work? Clayton will read the questions. By the way, I'm from Brooklyn, New York. Never knew a guy named Clayton. This is definitely not a Jewish guy. As soon as you hear a guy named Clayton, you know this is Protestant. It's okay, I don't mind, because I lived in a neighborhood that was just Jews and Italians. It was a great place to grow up. We didn't know what a first Protestant we knew was John Lindsay. Clayton.
First of all, I'd like to say hi to my father, who's past president of the Clifton Park Rotary.
Does that figure?
Uh, First question. I was wondering if you've ever handled a more tense debate than the one between Vice President Gore and Ross Perot. And I'm also wondering if you have any words of wisdom for an aspiring journalist.
Well, I like handling debates. I've handled them all my life. They're really, if you have any kind of experience, they're duck soup. Because all you got to tell yourself is you're the referee, you're there to see that they're treated fairly, you get in and out, and you're not, the only importance you have to the debate is the same thing a referee has in a heavyweight boxing match or at a football game. You should be in and out, see that it's run fairly, and let them go at it. I have had a lot of tense debates. When you came from Miami, boy, whew, I'm used to tense debates. I mean, I had a debate once between the mayor of Miami Beach and a guy running for mayor. I said, now let the debate begin. The mayor objected. We didn't even start, and we got a problem as to whether we could hold the debate. But that Gore-Perot debate, certainly for intensity, was like nothing I had ever experienced. First, since I know both men so well. Second, since both men, at least before the debate, knew and liked each other very much, that Gore issued the challenge, that it was, according to everything we can check, the first time a vice president has ever debated a citizen about a major topic. But it's probably the first time a vice president has ever debated, other than running for re-election. And I don't think a president has ever debated, although I think you're going to see all that change with this administration and with the emergence of electronic journalism. Once the debate started, my role was to keep it moving, keep it going, and it was difficult during the breaks because under the rules, by the way, Wendy Walker Whitworth, who is our sensational producer, who helped set this whole thing up after Al Gore called me, they set certain rules together with the White House, did CNN, and one of the rules was that nobody could come into the studio once the show started. That means none of Mr. Gore's assistants, none of Mr. Perot's assistants could come in. It was going to be a free-flowing debate, and they locked the doors. So it's me and the cameraman and the two of them. The cameramen are reading crossword puzzles. It was a big night. And I got the two of them. So on every break, we have three-minute breaks, and I got to sit with two guys who are really going at each other, and I'm trying to make the conversation move along, but I don't want to say anything that the audience will miss. So on the first break, I said, so, Al, how's her mother? She's doing better. Perot said, what was the matter? She had a little problem. Second break, we're into weather. Third break, no talking at all. It was an extraordinary. I mean, there'll never be a night like it. It was a once only. I was very proud to do it. I think it changed the course. We've changed the course of a lot of things in America, and this was one of the things that we'll now see presidents or vice presidents debate. We know that you can use things to change things around. Things do change through electronic media because it happens so quick and so many people tune in. And we're very fortunate to have this unusual show that's the only worldwide live talk show. I wouldn't trade places with anyone. But debates, of all the things I do, the easiest thing to do is moderate a debate. It's not difficult. And wisdom for a young aspiring journalist. Arthur Godfrey told me this a long time ago when I was just starting, that there's no secret in this business. No secret. The only secret is there's no secret. Just be yourself. If you really want it, you're going to make it. If I stood here and said you're not going to make it and that could change your mind about journalism, then you're not fit for it. There's nobody in it who doesn't love it. There's always room. There is no great talent, no great writer, no great broadcaster tonight living in Yukalaka Falls, Wisconsin, who can't make it. If he or she doesn't make it, it's through some fault of their own, but there's always room. I never saw a great talent who got shunted. So there's room for it. So if you're aspiring and you got talent, you're going to make it.
We haven't seen much of Ross Perot since Al gored him on your show. To what do you attribute this? Is he sulking?
Ross doesn't sulk. Ross, I've a lot of respect for Ross Perot. Four nights after the debate, I was in Texas at a book party at Neiman Marcus where Ross introduced me. He was the host of the party. It was funny. He said to the manager of the store, I'll take 10 books and put it on my account. And I said to the manager, do you know his account number? Are you sure he's good for it? Get it? Do you know his account number? Ross Perot, he could buy the store. And then that night he had a birthday party, his 60th birthday party for his wife. He's a great family man. And Ross was as happy as he just was having a great time. And I was speaking with his daughter, and we pretty much decided that Ross Perot has never debated in his life. That may have been his first debate. The presidential debates are not Larry King Live. They're very formal. They stand far apart. They don't interrupt each other. And you begin with a question for one, and then he responds, and then there's rebuttal time, and it's formal. Our show is informal, and I would wager that Ross Perot has never had an informal debate with anyone who took him on and who interrupted him and who came on as strong as Al Gore did. But you haven't heard the last of Ross Perot. He's an activist. He puts his money where his mouth is. He's got a lot of wonderful qualities that I've come to appreciate. Al Gore, I know, likes Ross Perot. I think Gore was just prime that night. I mean, he came in like a heavyweight champ. And I don't know if Ross Perot either had no experience debating, took him lightly, which could have been, might have taken him lightly. You know, Al Gore is suddenly a very serious player on the international scene. He's in Russia. He was in Mexico for the signing of NAFTA. He's a heavy player, and he showed that night that this guy is, you know, this is not, you're not playing with a loose deck here. This is a tough guy. That was a momentous night for him. And if you were sitting there watching it, you knew it just from body language. But Ross Perot isn't going away.
You've been criticized on your show for having a casual dress and a casual attitude towards politicians and other major figures. Your book mentions Tom Shales criticizing your dress code. How would you respond to his criticism and the criticism of others who complain that you don't address, say, a senator as Senator Smith instead of Jimmy?
Criticism's fair, although Tom Shales criticizing aesthetically is a riot. This is self-fulfilling prophecy. The Tom Shales Show, what will he wear? I like Tom. In fact, I met Tom last week. I said, Tom, I got 10 seconds, name all the people you like. I work casually because I came out of radio, and when I started doing television in Miami, I just wasn't a jacket kind of person. I liked either sleeves or a shirt or sweaters. I got into braces. My ex-wife, Sharon, said to me one day, you know, you'd look pretty good in braces. So I tried braces, wore them one night, and three people called and said, you look good. Now, all you have to do in this business is to have someone say you look good, and you're hooked for life. So now I got 700 pairs of braces, and I like it. It may be a calling card, but I'm comfortable, and if I'm more comfortable, the better the broadcast. I think it's very hard. I don't know how people do it. When you know someone a long time, and you know them as Bob, and then they become governor or mayor, it's very hard to say Governor Bob or Mayor Bob if you know them as Bob for years. Now, I've known Al Gore a long time. Ever since I've known him, he's been a senator, but I've known him socially, and he always says, I'm Al. When he called me that morning, he said, this is Al. Well, I have a tough time saying Mr. Vice President. I try to say Senator. I stand guilty if I can't, but it's a very human show, and again, it's live. And as for the question, I'm really into it. I'm an interviewer by nature. I interview myself. I'm intensely curious. I'm not curious about who someone slept with last night. I'm not curious about gossip. I'm not curious about the bizarre. I don't know why. I never was. When I was a kid, I wasn't curious about who's sleeping with who. That just never wasn't my kind of nature. But I was intensely curious about why would a bus driver want to drive a bus? Why does a pilot want to fly a plane? Why would you want to be president? That fascinated me, and it stays with me all the time. It still today would stay with me as to why are you doing this, and why did it rain today? What happened in the skies? What happened? Why did, you know, I was watching the weathercast the other night, and it said there was an inversion, and the weather was moving off the Atlantic coast and turned back. Why? I mean, it's insane to be like this, you know. My poor daughter had to be raised with this. Where were you today? Why'd you go there? And that's all I bring to the broadcast every night. And I listen. I listen to answers. And that's the whole key to interviewing. And, you know, we've been pretty successful at it. You can't change your style at this point. I accept fair criticism, and I'll try to call senators. Sometimes if you know them real well, it's hard to do.
Why do you have your suspenders hidden today?
Because this is the National Press Club. Well, I'll take them off. No, they're here. The best tribute I had was we went to Japan, and I was a guest on their version of Meet the Press. This was hysterical. So I'm the only person there speaking English. They had simultaneous translation. And the whole staff, the cameramen, producers, the directors, the host, the panel, all wore braces and no jackets. And it really made me feel nice. But I like this look.
Do you think politicians have undercut the press by going to talk show hosts directly?
You know, I don't know if it's undercut the press. I'm a press freak. One of the biggest thrills of my day is opening the door and finding the newspaper. I mean, I can't explain that. There's something about turning it, but the newspapers are part of the fabric of my life. And I love the Sunday morning shows. I love Meet the Press. I love the Today Show. I watch everything I can watch. Firing Line. I'm a fan. And I think all politicians should do all things. It wasn't my fault that they chose to do my show. And I wouldn't turn them down. I mean, I wasn't going to say to Al Gore, I don't think we ought to do it. Why don't you try something traditional? I'm very happy doing what I do, and I'm part of the mix. Now, the mix has changed. Cable has affected our whole lives. I mean, we can't deny that. If you have cable, if anyone in this room has cable, you know what it does to your life. You can't live without it. I mean, you can't travel. You ever go to travel and you get to a hotel that has 5 channels? You're out. Where is my cable? You know, you want those 50 channels. The clicker is our life. And that has therefore afforded us so many more opportunities to hear candidates and meet things. And the best thing I could say for this year was, in my opinion, we knew these candidates better than any candidates have ever run. The public knew them. And they became part of our lives. And we knew what they thought about things. We knew their opinions. This was not a public in the dark. This was not a campaign of 1-minute sound bites at airports that only got seen on Dan Rather. Now, I'm not against the politician doing everything. I'm just a part of the mix. The mix got bigger. The pie is larger. There are more slices. We're all in the game. And there's lots of roads. That's why I call the book The New Road to the White House, is there's lots of roads to get someplace. And the advantage of it is, I think the advantage of a show like ours is, if Bill Clinton or Robert Dole go on Larry King Live tonight, and they're very good, they're impressive, and people call in, ask them good questions, and they respond, and they sell you. In other words, you've watched them, and they sell you, much the same as Tom Hanks sold you to go see Philadelphia, the movie. He appeared on a show, he was very good. You got interested in the movie, you went to see it. Bill Clinton appeared on the show, he was very good. He got you interested in healthcare, you looked more into it. What it did was, though, if you saw him for the full hour and you liked him, the next day, what the op-ed page says is kind of irrelevant. Now, I love the op-ed page, but if the op-ed guy says, last night Bill Clinton looked nervous, but you didn't think he looked nervous, that's irrelevant to you. You saw him. The hardest thing in print journalism today, and as a lover of print I say this, is I don't see any headlines that shock me anymore, and I know the news. I know the news. I've gotten the news already. Electronic journalism has delivered the news. I don't wake up in the morning and say, wow, I know it. We know it because before I've gone upstairs, I've clicked on the television. It's right there. So what the paper has to bring me is something I don't know, insights I don't know. But when the paper tells me that they thought someone looked poor when he looked terrific, like, for example, debates. If you watched the Gore Perot debate, you made up your own mind. You didn't need the paper to tell you the next day who won. Well, but in the past, well, when it was just radio and you just had images coming from voices, or you weren't there at the press conference, and the printed press was the only, when I was a kid, I thought Time magazine was God. If Time magazine said, Harry Truman looked harried as he walked into a room, he looked shaken. Well, I had no other basis to go on. If I had television, I would have seen Harry Truman. And if he didn't look shaken, Time saying it wouldn't have bothered me at all. So it's a pretty good avenue. I'd use it.
As a newspaper columnist, what do you think the future of print journalism is?
Oh, I think we'll always have it. There's something about holding something and reading it again. I'm proud to be part of USA Today. I got a nice niche with them. I've been with them. I started a month after they started, and I do this Monday column, which everybody has fun making fun of because I get to write an stream of consciousness. Even David Letterman kidded about it last night, reading items from the column and then checking whether I had written them or not. But I like the print people. I worked at the Miami Herald for years. I love all the people at the Knight Ridder. I like the New York Times folks, the Washington Post. It's minimized. We're never going to see seven newspaper cities again. We're never going to see, you know, I grew up in New York with 11 newspapers. I read PM. I read the New York Post, the World Telegram, the Sun, the Journal American, the New York Daily News, the New York Daily Mirror, the New York Herald Tribune, the New York, wow. But now that's, you know, we're going to be one newspaper cities, in some cases two newspaper cities. Newspapers always be a part of it, but it's become an adjunct. It's not the main road anymore. I mean, even if you're in the print business, you have to admit that. Television is the most powerful media force ever invented anywhere. We're still in the beginning of it. Television isn't, when did television start? 48? Television isn't 50 years old. It isn't 50 years old. And there's no illiteracy if you have television. The world knows everything. You see freedom, and they said Albania would never be free. They turn on the television, knock down the walls. Television is so powerful. Whatever's in second place is a distant second. But there's a need for it all. There's a need for radio. There's a need for print. But they have to rethink what they're doing. Magazines have to change because you have to bring me something that I didn't see. I'm a sports nut. So when I open up the sports page, I read the box score. But I don't read, if I've seen the Bullet game last night, I don't read the story. I saw the game. You don't have to tell me about the game. You've got to tell me something I don't know. That's harder to do when I've already seen the same event you've seen.
How do you respond to critics who say that you throw softballs at your guests and that is how you attract the politicians?
Well, I never understood that, because I often ask, what is a softball question? I've never heard anyone tell me what it is. It's not a Pollyanna show. You can go to a million Pollyanna shows. Certainly it's not a how are you and how what's your latest movie. The audience wouldn't watch it, and the kind of people who watch that show wouldn't watch a Pollyanna show. I think what we do on our show is we ask very good questions. We listen to answers. We let the person speak. We don't interrupt the answer. We involve the audience. The show moves along at a good pace. I'm proud of what I do. I love asking questions. I listen to answers. There may be some jealousy. I mean, you know, we've taken off so far in the last 3-4 years. It's been kind of incredible. There may be some jealousy, but I never pretended to be other than what I am. I'm not. You know, I'm often asked, "Are you a journalist?" You know what? I don't know. I make journalism, obviously. I mean, we made a lot of journalism the last 3 years. But I look at myself as the style section. I think I'm the style section of the paper. I think I'm the feature. I do the feature part, and sometimes by asking good questions and getting the right people and mixing it well, those features make the front page. But I don't consider myself a journalist. I've never covered a war. I've never stood on a battlefield and described the battle. I think I could do it. I've never done it. But I'm fascinated with why the general wants to fight the battle. I think I'm more featured than journalist because I'm more fascinated with why the fireman wants to fight the fire than what caused the fire. Why would someone want to fight a fire? That fascinates me. Why would you want to put on this garb and walk into a building that's burning? Now, I'm interested in what caused the fire, and that's certainly part of the story. But the most fascinating part to me is why you'd want to fight the fire. And I think people like coming on our show because firemen like being asked that. Presidents like to respond to, how's the job? What surprised you about this job? What gives you a kick about it? What don't you like about it? Well, these are things that force people to think. That's what I try to do. And I think people like being questions when they're forced to think, and they like ask being questions about what they do. That's what I do.
This is our first internet email question from Canfield, Ohio. Larry, is the broadcasting and fairness issue as big a threat as some talk show hosts claim? One would think the nails and crosses are about to be brought out against some broadcasters.
Well, I know that most of my broadcast fraternity disagrees with me, but I'm a proponent of the fairness doctrine. I live with it all my life, broke in with it. I like it. I like the fact that we as broadcasters have to be fair. It is not out to get any broadcast. I know Rush Limbaugh thinks they're out to get them. All it means is that a station who has, if you have eight right-wing hosts, you better put some left-wing hosts on. I don't know what's wrong with that. I have never found a good argument against fairness. It doesn't take anybody off the air. God, it wouldn't take Rush Limbaugh off the air. It would mean the stations that play him also have to present other viewpoints. The hell is wrong with that? I never figured out why that's bad. Broadcasters are not print. We don't own the airwaves. Channel 4 doesn't own the sky. WRC radio at 980 on the dial doesn't own 980. I can go print the newspaper today and say anything I want, and I can get the venue and stand on the corner and sell it, but I can't go into WRC studios and take 980 on the dial. So as long as they have that by a right given them by us, the people, we own the sky, they don't. We own the airwaves, they don't. The inmates don't run the asylum. We give them the license to run it and make a profit. We have the right to regulate. We have the right to say, you shall do public service. We have the right to say, you shall be fair. Never bothered me.
Speaking of Rush, this question is from Austin, Texas. What is your opinion of Rush Limbaugh's popularity? Is he a flash in the pan?
Well, he's a very good broadcaster at what he does. He has a great appeal. He's a strong right-winger. The AM band on the dial, you know that... Radio's fascinating. I mean, I'm in the culture radio. I've been in it 37 years. And FM dominates radio. 75 to 80% of all people who listen to radio every day in America listen to FM. People under 30 don't know what AM means. What is AM? I've heard my daughter's friend once say, what is AM? What is that on the radio? AM. Okay. So what AM radio has become is the great place for news and talk